Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For African Americans in the early 20th century, getting an education was a challenge until Julius Rosenwald came along. Though he never finished school himself, this Jewish philanthropist rose to become the head of Sears Roebuck and Company and started a fund that built nearly 5,000 schools throughout the South, 800 in North Carolina, including Charlotte. These schools were built between 1913 and 1932 and gave black children an educational opportunity they would otherwise not have received during this era of Jim Crow. These schools came to be known as Rosenwald Schools and were hailed as the most important initiative to advance black education in the early 20th century. They were also a partnership between two remarkable men, Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington, who distinguished himself as an educator, author, orator, and advisor to several presidents in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, despite the color of his skin. Next month, the Charlotte Museum of History will highlight this unexpected partnership and explore the legacy and ongoing impact these schools had in Mecklenburg County and throughout the South. And joining us to talk about that and more are Andrew Feiler, Fanny Flono, and Dan Morrill. Mr. Feiler is a photographer and author, a fifth-generation Georgian who grew up in Jewish Savannah. His latest book of photography is titled A Better Life for Their Children, Julius Rosenwald, Booker T. Washington, and the 4,978 Schools That Changed America. His photographs form the backbone of an exhibit of the same name, which opens on February 5th at the Charlotte Museum of History. Thank you for joining us this morning. Welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Fanny Flo,
I'm glad to be here.
Well, hold on. I haven't introduced you yet. Don't jump the gun here.
Let me get to
Fanny. Fanny Flono is a name that you probably recognize because of her time at the Charlotte Observer. She is now trustee of the Charlotte Museum of History and chair of that organization's Save Siloam School Project, which is working to save one of the few remaining Rosenwald schools in Mecklenburg County. Good morning to you, Fanny. Now's your turn.
Good morning, and glad to be here.
And Dan Morrill obviously is here. He's a local icon when it comes to historic preservation and historian. And after retiring from the Historic Landmarks Commission, he helped found and is now the administrative consultant for Preserve Mecklenburg, which is actively looking to purchase historic real estate to preserve those properties for posterity. Welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Well, great to have you.
Glad you're here.
Well, so am I, because who would ask the questions? So, Fanny, let me start with you. We did a program on these Rosenwald schools, I think back in 2015, when a woman by the name of Aviva Kempner made a film about Julius Rosenwald that was screened here. And she was on the program at the time, called Julius Rosenwald the greatest philanthropist we've never heard of, given the unusual for its time, nature of the schools that he helped create and their remarkable impact. Why isn't he better known? Why aren't these schools well known?
Well, you know, one reason I think is that because that part of our history is not very well known or talked about, and particularly this year period after the end of the Civil War. And I think people were, there was a lot going on in the country that was not very helpful to African Americans. And so I think that this was just a time when people didn't talk, people today don't talk about that part of our history. It was a challenging part of our history in which segregation was deeply entrenched, and there was violence going on in a lot of parts of the southern parts of the country. And these schools were, especially because Julius Rosenwald reached across and racial and economic lines to joined with Booker T. Washington to establish these schools, that was not something that was done very often.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, that part of our history has been lost.
I know that, that
happened during those years.
I know, Andrew, you want to chime in on this, and I'll bet you you're going to tell me there's more to it than just that.
Well, no, first of all, I think Fannie's absolutely right. We are at a moment in our history where we have recognized that we need to diversify and tell a more comprehensive American narrative, that there are components of our history that we have not told. But I think there's another variable here, and that is that Julius Rosenwald was one of the earliest philanthropists to mandate that all the funds should be given away within a certain number of years of his death. That has become very fashionable in philanthropy today. Bill Gates has said that. Warren Buffett has said that. Bernie Marcus has said that. Julius Rosenwald believed that the people who helped create the wealth should be the beneficiaries of that wealth. And so he mandated that all the funds in the Rosenwald Fund should be given away within 25 years of his death. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they spend, Julius Rosenwald dies in 1932, they spend down in 15 years and the fund shuts down in 1948. So it's one of the reasons the Julius Rosenwald story is not as well known as some of his philanthropic peers like Carnegie and Ford and Rockefeller, who have surviving foundations that bear their name.
Dan, Julius Rosenwald's rise to wealth is a typical prototypical American story. It's the story that we all believe in and subscribe to. He was the parent. He was the son or the child of immigrants. He was Jewish. He did not finish school. He became a peddler who rose through the ranks as a salesperson and ultimately became the head of Sears and Roebuck Company, which he made into the most successful retail establishment of its day, the Amazon.com of the early 20th century. And somehow he came into contact with Booker T. Washington, another man who wasn't necessarily wealthy, but a man who rose to surpass anything that could possibly be expected of an African-American in that time period, to become highly influential. How did the two of them come together to help create these schools?
You know, I think, and I'm sure that others know more than me, because my knowledge of Rosenwald schools is largely derived from my involvement in preservation in Mecklenburg County. But I'm sure it was because of Tuskegee Institute. They certainly knew each other there. I might be mistaken. I don't think I am. That Rosenwald was a trustee. And, you know, let me give a little broader briefly. Can I preach for just about 30 seconds?
Sure.
You know, there were, race is the issue in American politics. It still is. You were in your introduction, you were talking about a court case. Race is the issue. Okay. How are African Americans going to be able to benefit from the full participation in our republic? I mean, that's the issue. And there were two men who had very different views. One was W.B. Du Bois, who said it was through the courts. And that, of course, is the NAACP approach. Booker T. Washington was an eloquent speaker. He was a man who could absolutely mesmerize a crowd. And he believed that the real approach was education. If African Americans could get an education, and a good education, and a solid education, that would allow them to have the skills to be able to participate in our society, and specifically to gain wealth and to become the and to participate in the American dream and the American story. And he also, a very important part of this Rosenwald thing was it was a team approach. It wasn't just that the money was all given by the Rosenwald Fund. There had to be participation by the local school system.
Yeah, and we're gonna talk about that, because it was a matching fund.
Okay.
It was,
I've said it was enough, but
that's okay.
But it was wonderful schools to get that education.
And we're gonna talk about the fact that this was a matching fund situation, okay. And I want to talk about how that could possibly have worked back then when the African American population was poor. Where were those funds going to come from? But Andrew, I getting back to how the two of these men come together and decide to build these schools. How did that happen?
So the first thing to say is Julius Rosenwald, has he, having become president of Sears, Roebuck & Company, becomes, as you mentioned, one of the earliest and greatest philanthropists in American history. And his cause is what later becomes known as civil rights. And he starts his first foray into philanthropic giving in civil rights issues in 1910, when he agrees to partially fund, a series of YMCAs across America, which results in funding 24 African-American YMCAs. Booker T. Washington hears about this, and he goes to Chicago, and the two men meet in 1911, so just over 110 years ago. Now, you have to remember that 1911 is before the Great Migration. So 90% of African-Americans live in the South, and public schools for African Americans are mostly shacks, with a fraction of the funding provided for the education of white children. Many jurisdictions do not even have public schools for African Americans. So Booker T. Washington invites Julius Rosenwald to come onto the board of Tuskegee. Later that year, Julius Rosenwald takes a train down to Tuskegee, is impressed with what he sees, and agrees to serve on the board of Tuskegee. But the two men develop this close friendship, and they keep talking, what can we do together? And it's in 1912 where they settle on this idea that they're going to create this program that becomes known as Rosenwald Schools and fund public schools for African Americans across the South. And in between 1912 to 1932, they fund 4,977 schools across 15 states. And then one final school was created in 1937. And the results are transformative.
So, Fannie, these 5,000, nearly 5,000 schools, how did the communities in which they ended up being located, how were they chosen? Was it strictly because Mr. Washington and Mr. Rosenwald thought, well, that's where we should put one? Or did the communities apply to be chosen?
The communities themselves applied to be a part of this program. And many of the communities, one of the stipulations, of course, with the partnership was, and this came from Booker T. Washington, that the communities themselves had to put money into the program, that they had to be active partners. And you talk about the communities being poor, but many of the people in these communities did own land. And they were artisans, they were tradespeople, and they could provide that sort of thing. But it was not only that the governmental agencies were required to give money and that the fund gave money. Of course, the Siloam School is a different animal. The Siloam School was built completely with community funds. The community provided the funds for all of the materials. And the only thing that the Siloam School got from the Rosenwald program was the plan. And the plans were very significant. The Rosenwald schools, as you look at them, are very distinctive. So you know a Rosenwald design school when you see them. But people applied for these. I mean, there were communities all around the South that wanted to have better schools for their kids. And so they were able to seek out these funds. I mean, there was a way for the Rosenwald Fund to provide these funds for these community schools.
I'm going to come back to this, the plans, the physical plans for these schools and how that came about and what the impact of that was and how unusual that may or may not have been for the time. We'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about the impact of the Rosenwald schools here and around the South. When we come back, we're talking about the Charlotte Museum's impending exhibit called A Better Life for Their Children on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Rosenwald schools. Some nearly 5,000 of them were built throughout the South. I think 800 here in North Carolina in the early 20th century, specifically to help African-American children become educated because there were few other options for that to happen. We're talking with Andrew Filer, a photographer and author of a book called A Better Life for Their Children, which documents these schools and which serves as the basis of an upcoming exhibit at the Charlotte Museum of History, which opens on February 5th. Fannie Flono is chair of the Save Siloam School Project, which is one of the Rosenwald schools or Rosenwald-based schools, and she works for the museum as well. And Dan Morrill is here, historian and founder of Preserve Mecklenburg. Dan, we were talking just before the break about how these schools were designed, and Rosenwald was very specific in how he wanted these schools to be built and how he wanted them to look. They had to be a particular color. Most of them had particular kinds of window treatments. They were designed and oriented in a certain way to bring daylight into the classrooms because many of these schools did not have access to ventilation or electricity. There was a central classroom in most of these places with an industrial space in the rear and a cloakroom in the front. Clearly, having these schools have the same basic design, it was more efficient. Was that too groundbreaking? I mean, were most public schools of the day developed and designed that way, or were they all different?
Well, the thing of that, obviously there was great variety in school designs throughout the country, but Julius Rosenwald, they had numbered plans. You know, my wife and I, when we take trips, we go down the road. We say, oh, there's a Rosenwald school. You know, oh, hey, there's another one over there. I was just talking to a young man down in Anson County wanting to save a Rosenwald school. And North Carolina, I have to say something about George Davis. Because George Davis, who was the first African-American professor at Johnson C. Smith University, became the North Carolina agent for the Julius Rosenwald Fund. And North Carolina was prolific, prolific with Rosenwald schools. They're all over this state. And a lot of that had to do with the untiring efforts of George E. Davis, whose house, by the way, has been restored magnificently by John C. Smith University. And by the way, there are white schools that used Rosenwald plans. Mm-hmm. The plans were so good that you'll see, you say a Rosenwald school, well, the answer ought to be probably, because they were so good, because it all had to do with light. The thing that is so overwhelmingly striking about these frame buildings, regardless of whether it's number one, number two, number three, number four, number five, number six, number seven, they all have banks of windows. And, you know, the reality is that the funding fundamentally came overwhelmingly from the local school system.
Yeah.
I mean, they had to put money up too. And they were frequently, by the way, located near an African-American church, because African-American churches, of course, were such important cultural, social centers of the community. It was just logical for them to be there. You can go, for example, to the Newell Rosenwald School. You can go to the Billingsville Rosenwald School, or you can go to the McClintock Rosenwald School, all of which are in Mecklenburg County, by the way. And, you know, they grew up in rural communities. They're wonderful.
Let's talk about that. We mentioned the fact that these schools were funded through matching grants. Julius Rosenwald put up a third of the money. A third of the money was supposed to come from the African-American community. And a third of the money was supposed to come from the governmental entities. And I think state school boards were responsible for a lot of the governmental share of this at a time when they did not provide money for education for African-American students. They couldn't go to the white schools, and so most of them, as Dan referred to earlier on, went to schools in shacks or not at all. So what, Fannie or Andrew, what was the motivation for these state school boards to put up the money when they wouldn't do it on their own?
First of all, let me flesh out the detail a little bit in terms of how the program worked, because the African-American community had to contribute, but they counted cash, land, material, and labor. So there was deliberately structured to invite multiple means of African-American community participation. And it's important to remember the Black community is already being taxed to pay for white schools, and they had to dig deeper to fund these schools.
So why did they do it?
So the short answer to that is really this broad narrative in American history. Education has been the access point to the American middle dream, on-ramp to the American middle class since before there was a United States of America. The first taxpayer-funded school in America is created in 1644 in Dedham, Massachusetts, and our cultural commitment to education goes back that far. And I'll just answer your question this way in terms of to tell you the story about where the title of my book came from. I was in most of these schools are no longer in use. Most of the of the 4,978 schools, only 500 survive, and only half of those have been restored. Very, very few are still in use for educational purposes because they outgrew that use long ago.
Sure.
I was in a school in Louisiana, which is still one of those unusual Rosenwald schools still in use for educational purposes. And I was talking to the principal who knew the history of the school. 70% of the money came from the Black community. And she marveled at that commitment. And she said, you know, they worked and they strove and they did what they could to make a better life for their children, because in their eyes, education was liberation. That speaks to the passion for education in these communities. They understood that education was the way into the promise of America.
Andrew, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, you first became aware of these schools in about 2015. And that was the same year that that documentary that we had the director of on to talk about, Aviva Kempner. She was on this program. Have the two of you spoken? Is that how you became aware of these schools? How did you become aware, and why has this become so important to you?
Yeah. So I've been a serious photographer most of my life. About a decade ago, I started down this path of taking my work more seriously and mercifully being taken more seriously. In late 2014, I turned in to my publisher what was my first book of photography, which was also on the theme of the importance of education, using the abandoned education spaces to talk about the role that education has played as this on-ramp to the American middle class, how that is a tradition at risk now with issues of college affordability. And I found myself at lunch in early 2015 with a woman named Jeannie Syriac, who originated the role of African-American heritage specialist at the Georgia State Historic Preservation Office. And she's the first person who told me about Rosenwald schools. And the story shocked me. I'm a fifth generation Jewish Georgian. I have been a progressive activist my entire life. The pillars of this story are the pillars of my life. How could I have never heard of Rosenwald schools? Mm-hmm. I came home and I Googled it, and I found that there were some books on the topic, but there was not a comprehensive photo documentary of this program. And I set out to do exactly that. And over the next 3.5 years, I drove 25,000 miles across all 15 of the program states. And of the 500 surviving schools, I shot 105 of those schools, and also met former students, former teachers, preservationists, and I bring their stories into this work with portraiture. And the last thing that I'll say is that I kept running into these schools being part of a broader web of American narrative. I found Rosenwald schools connected directly to the Trail of Tears, the Tuskegee syphilis study, litigation of Brown v. Board. And so I ended up feeling compelled to write a story that goes with each of these images. And so this is actually a book of both photographs and stories, and the exhibition will highlight both the images and the stories.
I was just going to get to that, Fanny. This exhibition is based on that book. It has the same name. It shares some of the same pictures. Now, of course, it shares some of the same stories that Andrew Filer got from people who either went to these Rosenwald schools or knew people, had members of their family go to these Rosenwald schools. Talk, Fanny, about the impact these schools had in the early 20th century and the legacy that they have left behind?
Oh, well, you know, I can't say enough about Andrew's book and his exhibit. I mean, it really does show you what we have to learn from the past and how it affects our future, or how it affects our present. You know, the Rosenwald schools, I mean, the legacy of them can be seen, obviously, if you look at his book and if you see the exhibit, you can see from the people who attended these schools how much those schools meant to them and how much they meant to their progression and their family success in the future. I had a cousin who I was telling Andrew, who died just a couple of years ago, and she was 102 years old. She attended a Rosenwald school, and she talked for years about the impact of going to a school where you didn't have to worry about whether or not you were going to be cold. You didn't have to worry about whether there were holes in the roof, that you could have, you had good books, that you could concentrate on your learning. My cousin, who attended a Rosenwald school in South Carolina, became the first person in her family to go to college and the first person in her community to get a master's degree. All of the people, some of the famous people who have attended Rosenwald schools, like John Lewis, Maya Angelou, I mean, all of these people kind of are testaments to the power of that educational opportunity back in those days. And so, you know, the Rosenwald Fund has tentacles that still go out across the country today. And one of the most important things about the Rosenwald School process is that it really did underscore that people can reach across race and economics and join hands to do something that's going to be for the betterment of the total community. And I did want to make one comment about the fact that the county did provide some funds for these schools. I think even back in those days, and I think one of the issues as we look at our history now, a lot of what we know about our history is not exactly on point. I mean, there were county leaders who were very interested in providing an education for Black people. Not the same kind of education that white people got, of course. They didn't want it to be on that level, but they understood that having a basic education for everyone was a benefit for the whole community.
Let's explore that for a second, because Dan, these schools came along well before Brown v. Board of Education, well before we even thought about the possibility of integrating schools, and at a time when separate schools for Black children were absolutely, unequivocally not equal to the schools and the education being provided to white children. So how did what these Rosenwald schools offer differ from what came along after integration? Dan.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because I went to a reunion at the Billingsville Rosenwald School, which is in the Greer Heights neighborhood, which, by the way, is in the National Register of Historic Places, and which has been lovingly restored. And if anybody wants to go and see a Rosenwald school, they would be well served to go, because it's wonderful. And here's the reality, and I'm going to say something that might be controversial. You know, change always cuts both ways, my friend. Segregation obviously was something that we look at from today, and we're glad it's gone. But when those children in that Billingsville school gathered the day that I went over there, I cannot tell you the love, the sense of memory, the sense of identification that they had with what they regarded as their school. And some of their teachers came, this was back in the 1980s, and some of their teachers came, and the respect and the love that those students had for those teachers was overwhelming.
So are you saying, are you, Dan, it's okay. Are you saying then that this kind of fits into a lot of things that we have talked about on other programs about this, that there was in these schools among the African-American community members who made them possible and among the young people who went there who then grew up and became adult alumni of these schools, that there was an investment in these schools on their part and pride on their part in the fact that these schools existed?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I tell you, the thing is, they were really, those teachers knew what those children faced. And they were very, very devoted to trying to do the best they could for those children.
So,
and those children looked upon that school as a haven. It was a safe place. It was a place where they could be affirmed. When they went out in the broader community, sometimes they didn't feel that. So you ask the question. It's not as simple. And you don't have to be. I'm not a progressive activist. I'm a moderate Republican. But I think the Rosenwald schools are extremely important.
Okay.
They're part of our history. And they're part of our story. And you don't have to be a political activist to be in favor of Rosenwald School.
So, Fannie, I have 60 seconds left in this segment. And I know that you are involved in this Save Siloam School project, which is a Rosenwald school. You're trying to raise $1 million for it. You've raised about $671,000 toward that effort. And in the 1920s, when this school was built, you talk about the janitor, Nelson Young, walking 5 miles every day to light the fire in the stove for heat and to get water from a spring for these kids. And you talk about the two major teachers in the early days of that school, Maddie Osborne and Margaret Gillard, who also had similar journeys to get to that school. That's a testimony to what these schools meant, right?
It's a testimony to what those schools meant to that community. And the, even, as I said, the building of the school by the community, scraping together the dollars that they had, leveraging whatever power they had, to build a school, as Andrew said, to have a better education for their kids. So yes, I mean, that is exactly what it was.
Fannie Flono is with the Charlotte Museum of History and the Save Siloam School Project. They're opening an exhibit in February called A Better Life for Their Children. We'll talk more about that when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Fannie Flono from the Charlotte Museum of History and the Save Siloam School Project, Dan Morrill, historian and co-founder of Preserve Mecklenburg, and Andrew Filer, a photographer and author of a book called A Better Life for Their Children, which serves as the basis for the upcoming February 5th exhibit, begins February 5th at the Charlotte Museum of History. And Andrew, in your book, as we mentioned, you pair these photos that you've taken as you traveled 25,000 miles across the South to photograph, find and photograph these, what remains of these almost 5,000 schools. You also talked to former students and teachers and community members about their impact and the importance of these schools. Can you share with us for a moment some of the stories that you were told about these students and teachers and community members' experience and what these schools meant to them personally?
So I'll give you one example. There is a photograph in this book. It's also in the exhibition. Imagine yourself inside of a small white clapboard school. Hanging above the doorway is a portrait of Julius Rosenwald that has hung on that wall since the K. Rose School in Sumner County, Tennessee, opened in 1923. And beneath them are two African-American men in their late 70s. That is Frank and Charles Brinkley. They both attended this school, the K. Rose School. They both went to college. They both went to graduate school. They both became educators. Charles became a high school math and science teacher. His brother became a middle school principal. They have four sisters, all went through this school, all went to college. These six siblings have 10 children, all 10 children went to college. That legacy may not have happened without this schoolhouse, this result, this schoolhouse that came from this partnership of Julius Rosenwald, Booker T. Washington, white school boards, and Black communities working together to make these schools happen.
And Fannie, that fits in exactly with studies conducted by the Federal Reserve, of all people, CBS News, of all institutions. CBS News reports that economists at the Federal Reserve conducted five studies on the impact of Rosenwald schools and found that prior to World War I, there was this enormous and persistent gap in the quality of and amount of education given to Black children versus white children. It was persistent. And that shrunk significantly between the world wars, specifically because of these Rosenwald schools, which speaks volumes about their importance then and their importance today because of the legacy they left behind. Was it simply the availability of an education as the result of these schools that made them so important, or was it the quality of the educators at the front of the classroom in these schools?
Well, probably both. From what I heard from my own family members who attended Rosenwald schools, I mean, the teachers were good, and they had better books and the facilities. I mean, you cannot say enough about having a facility that was not cold, did not have holes in the roof. You had desks. One of the things that one of my cousin talked about was they didn't have desks before they had their Rosenwald school. And so, I mean, all of those things, I think, combined help make the atmosphere for a better education for many of the kids.
And we do have an oversized share of these schools in North Carolina, as I think Dan pointed out, of these almost 5,000, about 16 or 17% of them are in North Carolina, and 20 of those schools ended up being in Mecklenburg County. Andrew, why? Why do we have an outsized number?
I think that there were 787 Rosenwald schools in North Carolina, more than any other state. There are more surviving Rosenwald schools in North Carolina than any other state. And then I think that had to do with two things. Number one, it had to do with the progressive leadership at the state school level and at the county school level. Most counties in North Carolina, the vast majority of counties in North Carolina, had Rosenwald schools. But also the commitment of the Black community to participate in the program and to be able to contribute and to make these schools a reality. And it cut, so the, both the white school boards and the Black community had to make the, had to participate, and that commitment came together more in North Carolina than any other state in the program.
Fannie.
And can I just add, because Dan did mention this, Professor George Davis, I think, was very significant. I think he was probably the best Rosenwald agent that they ever had. He went across the state encouraging people, having fish fries, having all these kinds of fundraisers to raise money to invest in these schools. So I think he was a very significant part of what happened in North Carolina, making us the one state to have the most Rosenwald schools, and Mecklenburg County to have the most Rosenwald schools of any county.
Dan.
You know, there's something I need to say about scale. You know, the idea got going after World War II, we ought to have big schools because that would allow us to have a wider curriculum. There's something about small schools. There's something about a small building. There's something about the intimacy that occurs. And the other thing was, largely because of these agents in the states and local school boards and so forth, you did have a cohesive community that was immediately geographically there, that was connected to that school. And there was this sense of ownership. There was this sense of, it wasn't a Rosenwald school, but I'll tell you this story briefly. I had a man who got an honorary degree, a distinguished individual, sitting next to me on the stage at the UNCC graduation, who went to a segregated school, the Morgan School in the Cherry community. And he told me, just tell you, I never would have gotten what I have gotten without going to the Morgan School.
Go ahead.
I mean, education is it's a very complex thing when it works and it doesn't work. It's an art form.
I want to get back to Mr. Rosenwald, Julius Rosenwald, and what made him pursue this and who he was as a person and the kind of person that he was. By all accounts, he was a humble man, as I think has already been discussed, who didn't believe in leaving money to foundations to spend after he died. He wanted it all spent very quickly after he died. And he also believed in spending the money while he was alive, which is something that we take it for granted now because of people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and others. But that was unique in that time period. He also had an opinion about rich people, such as himself, that seems important to hear in this day and age. And here is Julius Rosenwald talking about that philosophy in the documentary, Rosenwald.
Most people are of the opinion that because a man has made a fortune, that his opinions on any subject are valuable. Don't be fooled by believing because a man is rich, that he is necessarily smart. There is ample proof to the contrary. Most large fortunes are made by men of mediocre ability who tumbled into a lucky opportunity and couldn't help but get rich.
How refreshing is that? Let's go back to the early 20th century and to the people who came through these schools and who they are. Fanny mentioned several of them a moment ago, but let me just go through the list of alumni. This is going to blow your mind if you don't know this. Maya Angelou, the opera singer Marian Anderson, the late John Lewis, Washington Post columnist and Pulitzer Prize winner Eugene Robinson, playwright George Wolfe, Woody Guthrie, Ralph Ellison, Langston Hughes, James Baldwin. That's just a few of the luminaries who are alumni of these schools. What made these schools, Dan, so successful and able to turn out such a constellation of graduates?
Because the magic of the classroom worked. Because there were students who felt a sense of commitment to learning, and teachers who felt a commitment to teaching. That's when it always works. It's a two-way street. And if you don't have that, it just doesn't work.
Both you, Dan, and you, Fanny, are involved in the preservation of Siloam School. When you're finished, what will it become? Fanny, how will it be used?
Well, you know, we are planning programming that talks about not only that period of time, helps especially young people. We want to have young people to understand what it was like living in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, or in the South during those early 1920s and what education was like. But also we want the building to be used as a place where people can have conversations about educational inequities, about racial justice issues, about being able to have people come together to find cooperative ways to do things, to look at the Julius Rosenwald, Booker T. Washington model, to see how it fits into today. So we hope that the building will become a community resource where many, many kinds of issues will be discussed, and where maybe we can craft solutions to some of our present-day problems.
And Dan, you mentioned another of these Rosenwald schools in Mecklenburg County, the Billingsville School in Greer Heights, which was rescued in 2015 and rededicated as a community center. It was originally a frame building, as most Rosenwald schools of the time were, but the community got together at some point and raised $500 to have masons brick it up. As somebody who has devoted a major portion of their life to historic preservation and the promotion of historic preservation, tell us what we gain when we preserve things like Rosenwald schools and what we lose when we don't.
We are visual creatures. photographer. We are visual creatures. These things that we see in life as we go through what we call the built environment make us reflect and learn. History is not the past, as was said. History is our consideration of the past. You know, the great thing about the Rosenwald schools, and I hope this really happens with the Museum of History, I want just as many Republicans as Democrats go in that building. I don't want it to become a drumbeat for a particular political persuasion. It has to be, we are going to survive as a society with unity, cohesion. And that's why we need to have deepest respect for all aspects of the narrative. I'm totally in favor of a more inclusive interpretation of history. When we lose these buildings, we lose what we see. We don't go down the road and say, hey, there's a Rosenwald school. I mean, these things remind us. They're reminders of values. They're reminders of heroes. They're reminders of, well, anyway.
There used to be an old adage, seeing is believing.
Yes.
But that doesn't seem to hold true very much anymore with a certain segment of our population, which is very unfortunate because you can't survive when you can't see
something. It's because they see what's on TV. They see all these cable networks that grind out their own niche market propaganda.
Let's talk about part of the problem here and one of the boogeymen that has surfaced recently, and that is the alleged teaching of critical race theory in the primary and secondary schools in the United States. It is not taught at all. Never has been, never will be. It was designed to be something discussed at the law school level as a theory, but it's become the right-wing boogeyman for education. And CRT, critical race theory, examines the way in which racism operates now and historically in the U.S. system of laws and society. Can, Fanny, the preservation of these schools, as Dan Morrill is insisting, can they act as bringing back into the public consciousness the role that race has played in our development over time and in fighting against the CRT nonsense?
Well, I hope so. One of the reasons we want to save the Sloan School is because the Sloan School does tell a story about what education was like back in those days. And it's unfortunate that people don't want to see the whole picture of what our country was like at one point, because knowing what it was like tells you about why it is we are struggling now to get educational equity to the point that we want it to be today. So I think knowledge is power. I think having these buildings preserved, they tell the story, and you know, you have to be willing to listen to the story, the whole story.
And Andrew Filer, according to the documentary that I played a cut from a minute ago, Rosenwald saw a parallel between the Jewish pogroms in Eastern Europe and Russia and the kind of terrorism and oppression that Southern blacks suffered under the Ku Klux Klan. And you have said that as a fifth generation Jewish Georgian, these are the pillars of your life. Are there lessons to be learned for people who may be on the other side?
Well, so I'd say a couple things. First of all, Julius is specifically motivated by his Judaism. He sees America as a safe haven from anti-Semitism, and he sees that safe haven weakened by how we treat African-American citizens. And so this is the font of his interest in civil rights and the font of his philanthropy.
The exhibit at the Charlotte Museum of History, based on Andrew Filer's book, A Better Life for Their Children, opens on February the 5th. Out there on Shamrock Drive. Thank you all for being here. Andrew Filer, the author and photographer, Fanny Flono with the museum, and Dan Morrill with Preserve Mecklenburg. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.